This is Alan Minsky, and we're continuing the conversation here in the series Building a Powerful Left in the United States of America. I'm joined by Larry Gross from the Annenberg Institute. Scott Tucker is a writer for TruthDig.com and a Democratic Socialist. And we're joined now by Bob Scheer, he of TruthDig.com and his most recent book, The Great American Stickup. Let's continue with what Scott was saying, but I want to throw back all the way to your work to a time of a tremendously powerful international left. You've written on Rosen Luxemburg and the libertarian left. Libertarianism has somehow gained traction in the first 2 years of Barack Obama's presidency in the United States, but it's a libertarian right. So what is meant by the libertarian left? Sort of a softball question there. And how does it relate to the current president of the United States, or how could it?
Yeah, the big question is kind of who owns liberty? And there are conservative views of the public sphere and liberty, and those are very well represented in the United States right now. But if you look back, not so far back into the previous century, libertarian was a word that was commonly used for the small d democratic left. And it had a whole spectrum, and it shaded over into a very significant anarchist movement, for example, that played a significant role in all of the Latin countries, France, Spain, Italy, and even across the ocean in Argentina, which had a very significant syndicalist and anarchist labor movement. These were important movements, and left historians tend to devalue or underplay just how strong the anarchist labor movement was. Myself, I'm more of a democratic socialist, but it does underscore that the word libertarian is not owned by the right or the left. It really means for the left that you're serious about democracy, you're serious about public freedom, and you're serious about civil liberties. In this respect, I might note that the New York Times itself on its front page noted that Hillary Clinton and Obama, when they're talking about this uprising taking place throughout North Africa, Egypt and Yemen and other places, they're talking about universal rights, including free speech and assembly, but they're very carefully not talking about open and free elections because, of course, the United States has been a big supporter of many of these dictatorships for decades. So if we're talking about the libertarian left either across the ocean or within our own borders, I also believe in regime change at home, so that we have to get serious about open and fair elections in the United States of America.
Yeah, this is Bob Scheer. You know, I'm intrigued by this because I think where the left went wrong was not so much in a failure to choose between these two parts of Scott, the democratic socialist or libertarian, but to not take seriously the democracy part of socialism too often. Particularly when we were concerned about people around the world struggling against the U.S. imperial machine and so forth, we tended to sometimes apologize or what have you, but not recognize that, you know, the key thing in socialism was the democratic component, and to beware of what happens when it becomes part of a bureaucracy, when it becomes part of a machine, when individual rights are lost. And to the degree that I find the libertarian views exciting is to the degree to which they do stress the individual and not manipulating the individual and the individual having some control and over their lives. And I, when I think of my own involvement with the left, you know, my father was actually in the Wobblies. You know, he was a machinist and he was a Wobbly, and then, you know, briefly flirted with the communists, that they kicked him out, you know, because he wouldn't go along with them on settling labor strikes. He was a union organizer, shop steward. But, you know, my leftism became part of the Beats. You know, I was, I mean, the reason I was became a leftist, other than the fact of having garment worker parents who were, you know, progressive and decent and in struggle, was I found in Greenwich Village or, you know, the early Beats or so forth when I was growing up as a kid in New York. I found, and Scott earlier in the show mentioned the War Resistance League Bayard Rustin and these people, A.J. Musty, I found this to be really exciting because these were people who were not Stalinists, who hated communism, who understood what a trap it was, and had a vision of freedom that also was consistent with what the Beats were talking about. Allen Ginsberg, who incidentally was one of the first major gay writers that my generation was introduced to, but generally, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who had come out of the war, had seen the bombing, effects of bombing in Hiroshima while he was in the military, comes out and by the way, influenced very much by Pacific Radio, listening to it in Berkeley in the early stations. And these people in the Beat movement, key to their whole view was individual freedom, respect for the individual, and a fear of bureaucracy, fear of big government. And I think where the left went wrong in my lifetime certainly was being too, I don't know what the right word is, tolerant or apologetic on occasion for what were clearly authoritarian, if not totalitarian, movements. In the name of, you're in Vietnam or you're somewhere and you're struggling against a big empire and you have to make compromises. And then those compromises turn out to be very destructive of the needs of those people. So I do believe there are universal ideas of individual freedom, that they should be wrapped up in the democratic part of democratic socialism. However, the reason the socialism, and I love the fact that Scott brings it up, and maybe we should talk about it, is we have to have freedom. This is what I also felt as a kid. It's all very well and good for rich people down in Manhattan to talk about democracy and everything when they hold all the levers of power. And my parents are working in a garment factory for, 8-10 hours a day, and they're supposed to figure out what's going on, and they have no power. And so I think the combining the democratic socialism is absolutely critical. And that's what we're missing now. We have really no sense at all of the suffering of ordinary people, which deprives them of their democratic rights. If you're worried about your job and you're worried you can't pay the bills and everything else, then this democracy thing seems like a luxury. So you have to combine the two.
I think the one of the great tragedies of the 20th century, and one that we're still suffering from, was the identification of the left with Stalinism, with authoritarianism, which was a kind of sort of convenient coalition, if you like, both between the Stalinists and the right. The Stalinists were happy, the Communist Party, the Central Committee, were happy to have everything collapsed into them as the real thing. Everything else was a heresy or a deviation that needed to be stamped out. And the right was happy to do it because it made them an appropriate enemy. And from the beginning, from the Palmer raids or whatever, the anti-Bolshevik card has been played over and over and over again, so that when we reach the post-Second World War era and the Cold War, you get this kind of situation in which the left has been tarred with a charge, and in fact an accurate charge, of authoritarianism and totalitarianism, and everything else then is collapsed into it, so that socialism becomes a dirty word in this country. And I'm really talking about the United States, in fact, especially the United States. This is a country in which political positions that are taken for granted in other countries are viewed as beyond the pale. So that calling someone a socialist, as we've seen this recently with Obama, is a way of saying, off the scale, beyond the fringe. It rules out of order things that, as Bob and Scott were saying, are absolutely essential to any real left.
Well, and I wonder about the term left itself. This has come up a lot as I've organized this series. It seems like it really is a necessarily expedient shorthand, because what we're looking at in the contemporary United States are two factors that are really at the center of the severe crisis we're in. One is the increasing inequality in wealth at a time when the vast majority of people are experiencing a level of economic fear that they haven't seen in their lifetimes, because pretty much had to have been an adult or a near adult in the Great Depression mm-hmm. to have known anything like this. And secondly, the democratic system is overwhelmingly influenced by big money, again, the very sector that is still continuing to prosper in the economic crisis. So and both sort of definitional elements of the left quote unquote, coming out of the French Revolution, right? More economic justice for the people, representing their economic, the balance of the population's economic interests, and their rights to have a say in governance and political power. So it seems like a necessarily expedient shorthand. But as somebody who studies communication, do you feel that the left is tainted too much as socialism?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, not only is the left tainted, they give ground routinely. So, you know, liberal now has been collapsed into socialist and progressive. You know, you sort of keep looking for a term that hasn't been co-opted. And the left is unable to stand up for itself. It is always acting defensively. It is not aggressive in the way of saying yes. And I think the key problem you're talking about communication is that the battle that has been decisively won, or at least so far won, is the battle for an understanding of the political system on the part of, you know, the masses, on the part of the people. It is so controlled by a corporate worldview in which the people at the bottom identify, talk about identity politics, identify with the people at the top. I mean, look at the tax cut fights, you know, in which people are being mobilized, you know, people, you know, low down on the economic scale are being mobilized to fight for the rights of the people at the top, to, you know, pay less taxes and get rid of estate taxes and so forth. I mean, the co-optation of the popular, imagination by the right has been enormously effective. It's a rhetorical victory.
And I want to go to Scott in a second, but if I can just direct right back to you very quickly. Obviously, you're at Annenberg. You must study this type of messaging. How can this be reversed? What would be your quick points to make so that this can be reversed?
It's a very unequal battle. They control so much of the public space. I think the only hopeful thing that has come along in recent years is the internet, because the internet, at least so far, and they're doing their best to change that, the internet has a lower threshold for entry. So you don't have to be a multinational corporation. You don't have to be an enormous corporation in order to get access to the public sphere through the internet. That is an opening. It is being utilized, and I hope be utilized more.
Socialism is a word that is so loaded by now that there's a temptation among a lot of people to say it's dead lumber, throw it overboard. Well, I don't think we can do that any more than we can simply throw over the whole language and vocabulary of the left. And the reasons, I think, are pragmatic. They're not ideological so much. It's that human beings use language, and we tend to use language in conventional ways that refer to past experience and features in the landscape. That's always going to be human. It's just that basic. It's ABC. Socialism is a word that is used as a bludgeon and a hammer and a blunt weapon. So if you can charge Obama, who's basically very Clintonian in his economics and his way of dealing with Wall Street, if you can charge Obama with being a socialist, then of course we're through the looking glass and we're living in a kind of a world of projection from the far right. Does that mean we should give up the word? I say no, because it becomes an endlessly regressive battle. No matter what you do, and indeed no matter what you say or write, no matter how inventive you may be with language, they will still take the language of the left or of progressives or of small d Democrats, whatever you want to call yourself. They will take your language, your slogans, your issues, and put them through their far right ringer. And you will still have to come back to square one issues of matching words with reality. So if we're talking about socialism, one of the ways to redefine it is to say, let's look at actually existing socialism now. Let's look at social democracy in Europe, and more to the point, let's look at the whole string of electoral successes south of the border. From 1998 to 2009, the Democratic left won national elections in many Central and South American countries. I could tick them off one by one, but I won't do that. But there have been a string of national elections that have been won by different sectors and parties of the left in South and Central America. And this is very significant as an example that we should be paying attention to. We should be less provincial. It's as though the United States of America is a kind of ideological Australia, and we don't have Canada or Mexico above and below us. We just have ocean, and we're an island. We should really be paying attention beyond our borders.
And I just want to add about that, too. When people look at the global economy and the nations that have weathered the storm of the international crisis, people point to China, of course, and to somewhat India, but really a country that has performed as well or better because of progressive economic stabilizers has been Brazil.
Absolutely. Okay.
And a major country in Latin America that has been hurtling into ever greater chaos is the largest country that has not been a part of this electoral tide of left, center, left, and left victories, which is Mexico, right below our border. López Obrador came very close to ascending to the presidency. He didn't. And with him not doing that, bringing social democratic reforms into the society, it's hurtled into near chaos. Bob Scheer.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think social democracy has been very helpful, not only to the countries you mentioned, but in Western Europe, even when non-social democrats are in power. Germany is doing quite well because the things that we're talking about are really not even debatable anymore. I mean, but I want to plead guilty to this. I am one of those who led the fight to drop the word, if you will, not explicitly, but when I was editing Ramparts, when I was one of the people active in the New Left, I felt it was, what did Scott say, lumber to be thrown overboard. I felt it carried too much, it was too much a bad baggage. And first of all, I had visited some of these so-called socialist countries that weren't democratic. And I found it incredibly depressing that they were more effective in oppressing workers than the capitalist countries. So the technical ownership of the means of production, which was so involved in that word socialism, struck me as less important than some other things like careerism, class perspective, the right to organize, how you give out rewards. This is a big subject, and I don't want to give some simplistic take on it. But I think the very people who rose under Clinton to benefit Wall Street and then go through the revolving door and work for Wall Street, the Robert Rubens, the Lawrence, so all these people, they'll do very well in a communist country. They'll do very well in a social democratic country. And that kind of careerism and self-interest and individualism and materialism seems to thrive. And it's only held in check when you have pressure from below of ordinary people saying, wait a minute, you're not serving us. And when the ability to manipulate the views of ordinary people is limited by something. Now, the internet, as Larry mentioned, is one way that that has worked out. We see in Egypt, however, where they were able to turn off the internet just suddenly. You know, we've got to keep that in mind. The internet can be an imperfect filter. But, you know, I get back to the democratic part of this, or if you like, the libertarian part of this. I think the key is do people have the ability to, first of all, educate themselves, get information, challenge, and organize and be out there? That's the key thing. And or will they be co-opted? Will they be manipulated? And something we never talk about is the meritocracy in this country, which has replaced the sort of socialist idealism that some people grew up on. Certainly I did. And that was, oh, we all have a chance. And what happens? Yes, we all have a chance to sell out. We all have a chance to betray what we know from growing up. You know, and you see that a lot. You know, we have a chance to forget about those we leave behind. Barack Obama is a perfect example. And what I would suggest, I think it's all very well and good to appeal to social democracy as one center of idealism and concern for the other. I think you can just as readily appeal to Christianity, for instance. Christ. You go back to Confucius. Actually, in Confucius, there's a thing about the doctor. And it's not enough to be a good doctor that you know about medicine and can heal patients, but if only you're interested in profit and not the well-being of your patients in society, then you're not going to be a good doctor. That's in Confucius. That's 300 years before Aristotle talked about the general well-being of the city-state. He was 300 years before Christ talked about the most vulnerable and attacked, basically, you know, the money changers and usury. So I think wherever you get that tradition from. And I do think the struggle of labor unions and socialist movements is one very important reservoir for that kind of concern for the average person, the downtrodden, and so forth. That's what we lost in this country. We have this idiotic idea that somehow we should forgive the Robert Rubens and everything because they give some money to the Harlem Dance Group. Or, you know, or they're pro-choice or something. And we are perfectly willing to have this idea that somehow, you know, the rising tide of Kennedy will lift all ships. It doesn't lift all ships. And it certainly doesn't in what we've seen in the last decades. We see people who are being just cut loose in this multinational economy where we forget, you know, what they have in Brazil and Germany, you know, a recognition they have to care about who lives in their society. We've lost that.
Speaking with Larry Gross, Scott Tucker, and Bob Scheer, this is Alan Minsky, and this is part of the series Building a Powerful Left in the United States. And I want to ask the question, if a left could somehow magically, as it were, maybe as a product of projects like this, get a clear sense that it represents the alleviation of poverty, greater prosperity for the majority of the population through strategies perhaps like social democracy, that they also, because of that, the alleviation of fear due to the economy and advocacy for a classical libertarian form of like maximum liberty for everybody, were it able to get this idea focused in a sort of critical mass of people who would describe themselves as leftists, is the population of the United States going to be responsive to that message right now? I mean, there is this sort of issue of people living in this somewhat post-postmodern hologrammatic world where the left doesn't have a voice relative to the right. Larry, your thoughts?
Well, I'm not optimistic. I think that it will take things breaking down a lot more before people are willing to risk the status quo. And that's what, you know, they'll be told is the danger. I think, in addition, the scale of this country makes it extraordinarily difficult to imagine the kind of organizing. I mean, the countries that we've seen just now in upheaval, Tunisia and Egypt, are much smaller, and where we're seeing the upheaval is in their major, right, you know, metropolitan areas. Most of the country will find out what happens as it happens. A country on, you know, on a continental scale of this size makes it very difficult to imagine that kind of movement. Now, it can happen in some ways, and it has happened from time to time within a narrow focus. But I really think And, you know, probably the best example we have, although, you know, even Bob isn't old enough to remember it that well, in the 1930s, there was a sense that things had gotten so bad that change had to happen. And even that change was relatively confined. But it was, you know, it, certainly by the standards of the last few decades, it was an amazing period of accomplishments. That was a level that I think was the equivalent in a way of what's happening in North Africa now, which is the level of public outcry and of public dissatisfaction could no longer be ignored, and people couldn't be bought off. But the, you know, the engine of American capitalism has been able to buy people off, either through the individual mobility that Bob was talking about, so that your career, and, you know, some of the middle-class people now are trained in career mobility from kindergarten, or of a general sense of material satisfaction that is unprecedented in the world and unsustainable.
Right, and tremendously cheap commodities, cheaper than they were a few decades ago, and in great abundance, of course.
No, the whole thing right now, this why it's global, is that we have been fueling the Chinese economy and undercutting American productive capacity through incredibly cheap goods, which people, you know, they may not like every aspect of it, but they buy them. And this cycle goes on. So it, you know, we have to founder on the rocks here, I think, before people realize that this is just not going to work.
Scott Tucker?
China, since it has come up. Officially, there's a Communist Party running China, and it's become yet one more example of late corporatism. It's a classic corporate structure, top-down, and in fact, the Communist Party of China is dropping the hammer on any number of independent efforts to form labor unions in China. This is one of the great untold stories that we hear very little about in this country. But there are efforts to form independent labor unions, which you would think would be one of the foundation stones of an officially communist regime. But in fact, they're terrified of the working classes of China because it's that big. Taking an independent path apart from the party. And of course, Kissinger, for example, has been doing business with the Chinese gerontocrats and communists for decades. On socialism, I don't think we can drop the term. I am a socialist. I'm not giving it up for anybody. To me, it's not dead lumber. It's radical and it's still alive. And the problem with giving it up is that no matter how much we run from the history of the left or try and wrap ourselves in shades of pink rather than red, they're still going to call us commies. They're still going to call us reds. They're still going to call people who are quite mainstream corporatist career politicians socialists. So there's no running from the term. It's always going to catch up with us. So my view pragmatically is that we have to stop running, face the music, and have the debate in public about what socialism and democracy really means. There's a sense in which small d democracy historically was at root, they're really radical movement, because socialism is a kind of extension on a class basis and on an economic basis of democracy. So if there's a future for the democratic left, it really has to begin with small d democracy and then be very serious about tackling class and economic issues along the way.
Yeah, let me make this a little more concrete. I think this came up with the financial meltdown. You know, you couldn't have a worse track record than what had happened with the securitization of debt and everything that was done, using laws that they had purchased, they had lobbied for, and so forth. So you had absolutely clear, and this is what my book, The Great American Stick-Up, is all about. You just couldn't have a cleaner case of where they had hired the politicians, hired the intellectuals, the mathematicians, whatever, to concoct phony. It's a scam. It's a ripoff. And the public pays. And this latest report of the Financial Inquiry Commission comes up with some $12 trillion in wasted monies and so forth. It's just horrendous. So one possibility would be for the left, and some on the left said, let's nationalize these people. That was a non-starter. It was a non-starter largely because they control the media anyway, and they could present these terrible narratives, and there is no culture in this country to sustain such a discussion. There's, on the contrary, all this sort of brainwashing and endless propaganda about how that would be fascism and totalitarianism and so forth. So then we got tagged with regulation. Like, we're the ones who want, and even now Obama is attacking those who want sensible regulations because we want unneeded regulations and so forth. And I keep asking in my columns and so forth, why isn't this about anti-fraud? Why isn't that our goal? I don't like regulations. I don't like to be told where to drink and where to smoke and who to sleep with or what have you. I've never liked it. I've always, as I said, found my greatest happiness as a beatnik. You know, I'm not interested in government intrusion into my life and everything. So I try to turn it around. I say, well, why isn't this anti-fraud? The power of the state exists, whether it's in China, whether it's in Brazil, whether it's here, okay? The question is, what is the countervailing power? Who controls the state? How can you mitigate it? Where does the democratic element come in? And in case of banking and everything, instead of using the word regulation, I think the left should talk about anti-fraud. Because if you're home, you can't make the payments and they're going to seize your home, the banker is not going to come and seize your home. They don't do that. It's the marshal. It's a cop. It's the sheriff. They'll seize your home if you don't get out. You know, so the power of the state is there whether you like it. It will send you to war. It will take your taxes. It'll, you know, now here in Los Angeles and other big cities, they're paying their bills by giving you, what, $400, $500 for a wrong left turn. Santa Monica, the great progressive city, you can pay $70 for a parking ticket. This is a steep regressive taxes. So the power of the state will operate whether you like it or not. The question is whether it will operate for the interests of the most vulnerable and the ordinary people. And I think the left has not taken on that debate. This is not an issue of favoring big government. We fell into a kind of liberal trap. Why are we for big government? Why am I for a big federal government? Yeah, why not for states' rights, okay? Why not? States would probably do a better job experimenting on a whole range of issues, including marriage. You know, so yes, there are should be a certain inviolate human rights which are enshrined and should be enforced. But in terms of how to deal with poverty, how to deal with education, if the states could keep their resources, if they could experiment, that'd be a lot better. Why are we for a big government? And I think the danger, and this is where I would disagree with Scott on the use of the word socialism, is it's not just a matter of their having a weapon against us. Socialism, whether we like it or not, came to be identified with big, bureaucratic, powerful, and often, not always, as Western Europe is different, but often totalitarian, repressive regimes. So it is a baggage that I think—
By that standard, you know, we have to give up lots of other words as well, including democracy, which in the minds of many people in this world is associated with imperial wars. So it's not as though we can go back to an ideological Garden of Eden and choose our words to mean only what we want.
Right. The second the words came out of my mouth, I realized that was an effective counter-argument. I don't want to run away from the debate. I think the left has to, just as the right does. I don't know why we don't ever push the right or the center. No one ever pushes the center to explain anything. I mean, the best and the brightest of the center have made life miserable for more people in this world than probably any other movement, but they're never held accountable. But I think the left can take on certain arguments. I guess let me forget the label. I'll even accept the label. If we make clear the democratic component, if we make clear we hate bureaucracy, if we make clear that we don't respect big government because big government mostly is at the service of big business, okay? You know, I'm really talking about recapturing an image of progress, not the label.
Okay.
You know? And to the degree you want to talk to me about what's happening in Brazil now, it's very exciting. Very exciting, because there was a genuine workers-led movement coming out of the left, Lula and so forth, coming out of, you know, a definite socialist left that has done something in the most important economy in Latin America, one of the most important in the whole world, and shown that they could be progressive, they can produce good products, take care of their people, and still be socially responsible. So, yes, there are good social democratic models.
Well, We've got to wrap up soon here, but actually I'm going to throw in a little bit more than I generally have in this series. The left, broadly understood, has been successful and victorious coming out of oligarchic societies, which contemporary Brazil is still rising out of. I mean, nobody would confuse the neighborhoods of the prosperous for the neighborhoods of the masses of people in Brazil or anywhere even close to the contemporary United States in that regard. So if you look at societies that have massive class divides, the left is victorious. Once you establish a middle-class society in technological industrial societies, the left has retreated. If you look at the establishment of the great prosperous middle classes across the Western technologically developed world in the post-World War II period, it maintains itself. And then with Reagan and Thatcher, it starts to go back towards free markets, at which point the middle class gets chipped away. There's no vision for there was no winning vision for the continuation of a progressive society to become, as it were, more deeply entrenched in social democratic programs that maintained a wealth equality and created greater liberty, greater economic freedom. Generally, even in countries like Germany, from about 1980 forward, you have a chipping away. I mean, France made a few efforts with the 35-hour work week with the French socialists, but other than that, you'd really be hard pressed to see a society that tried to implement further, you know, classically progressive social democratic or even socialist reforms. And I do think, however, that the United States is a very dynamic society. It seems to be in a severe crisis. It's moving back towards oligarchy, so it becomes fertile territory for the reinvigoration of the left potentially. But I think that that means the left has to be creative in terms of its vision, which is where we are. And I do want to make one point about Bob's point, because I do agree. It is almost impossible to imagine the national government promoting, you know, truly progressive economic programs, whereas states, say Vermont, it's very conceivable. However, of course, the question is financing. It's the federal government that can print money. The states can't do that, so you sort of need a federal component. But I agree, some very profound progressive experimentation could take place.
I'd like to make a 30-second pitch, too, for something I haven't mentioned so far. I am a member of the Green Party, and I am also a member of the Socialist Party of the United States. Now, politics should not be limited to election days, because that really is a dead end. Politics is 365 days a year, and it means all of us engaged at every level of our local and indeed the national community as well. But to the fatalism of people who say it's only pragmatic to vote by rote for the lesser of two evils, we have to keep in mind, certainly in my lifetime, what I have seen, and living through the AIDS epidemic and any number of wars, is that the Democratic Party is the essential corporate dance partner of the Republican Party. They work in tandem. They play musical chairs in Congress to such a degree, especially with the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court, which really sells democracy to the highest bidder, that Congress has really become the front office of the ruling class. There's a way to take that on. It's to go into the voting booth and be brave. Don't vote your fears. Vote your conscience. Vote principle. Shake them up.
Thank you, Scott Tucker. I can see Bob Scheer has a final thought.
Well,
but we won't call it a rant.
It won't be a rant, but I. you know, I had a different thought. Let me ask Scott, because I think what happens at election time, maybe you stick with the Green Party or something, most people I know get concerned about, you know, the Supreme Court, the lesser evil, so forth. If we have the Republicans in, women will, you know, and women, everybody, you know, the choice issue, gay rights, you know, so forth. And so, you know, you travel in these same circles. Something happens that doesn't seem to happen as much on the right. The right, let me just give a historic analogy if I can, if we have a few more minutes. Barry Goldwater lost an ignominious defeat to Lyndon Johnson. It did not destroy the right-wing movement. It became the occasion for the birthing of the right-wing movement, amazingly enough. And it did not become an occasion for selling out. It became an occasion for educating and reinforcing, whatever you think of the Goldwater movement. It certainly went on to great success and actually captured the Republican Party, was transformed. On the other hand, George McGovern lost a similar kind of defeat to Richard Nixon. And for all the discrediting of Nixon, and despite the fact that McGovern had been a war hero in World War II, the Distinguished Flying Cross and everything else, somehow you don't even hear McGovern's name mentioned by Democrats. And you know, they want to bury. We don't want to become like McGovern. We don't want to lose and so forth. And there's a certain psychology that seems to dominate the Democratic Party that the Republican conservatives were freed of. And that we all know it. Comes election day, and you can say, Scott, correctly, politics has to be all year round, but they have that trump card that they play. And let me ask you, as a gay male, a person who has been active and fighting for human rights and for gays, what do you say to people who say, no, at least Obama did the military, at least blah, 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 you know?
I owe nothing as a gay man to the goddamn Democratic Party. I never expected that straight people or my family or the church or the Boy Scouts or the Democratic Party were going to give me anything real. Not health care, not a real education in reality, nothing. So from way back, any job that I've held has been working class jobs other than being a writer. So my class view on this is that the lesser of two evils is part of the structural, and I agree, it's real life, but it's also ideology. It's telling people you have no choice except the so-called pragmatic choice of voting against the Republican Party. Never mind voting for the Democratic Party, because even many Democrats are ashamed to make that argument by now. But then I also have a class view of elections. It's the big elections. Of course, you have to be in the arena. And if you can possibly get a public forum, by all means, make your pitch for your program on the left. But in order to even get into the electoral arena, we need some very deep and serious electoral reforms in this country. We need to take democracy in this country so seriously that we tackle redistricting laws. We tackle the fact that in Pennsylvania you have a Democratic Party mafia that has a lockdown on elections and shuts out insurgent candidacies and programs. You need to tackle the fact that we need instant runoff voting and proportional representation. Mm-hmm. These are all practical reforms that we need to take a lot more seriously, because we can either have the so-called two-party system in this country or we can have democracy, but we can't have both.
Yeah, can I just throw in a thought on this? Because I agree with you. And when I look at, I mean, I always fall for the lesser evil. I won't deny it. And when I look back on, you know, all this time I've been writing, the damage done by the lesser evils that I voted for has actually been greater than that done by the greater evil people. I think if George W. Bush or John McCain had been reelected and he had followed the same policies that Obama has followed vis-a-vis Wall Street, throwing all this money, getting so little in return, I think the country would be up in arms. I think the Democrats are not just a dance partner, they're more effective at it. I think if George W. Bush had escalated Afghanistan, I think the country would be up in arms. And instead, Obama has very effectively sold it. So I think, reluctantly have to agree with you on this.
I think one way to think about it is that the Democratic Party is a company union. And they know the deal. You know, they have to play along in a certain way. They have to bring their people with them and accept the terms that are being given by the bosses. You know, the Republican Party is a corporate union too, but it's a corporate union that's a lot closer to the executive suite. But both of them are in service of, you know, the owners. And this was even before Citizens United, which kind of made the whole thing obvious. But, you know, and this is a somewhat different take on some of the things we just said earlier. The Democratic Party and the unions were completely complicit in the Cold War expansionism because it meant jobs at home. I mean, the deal always was. I mean, the military-industrial complex is a source of jobs. And the unions were pro-war in Vietnam for a long time.
Yeah.
If you remember, when Martin Luther King came out against the war, that was not popular among the unions. That was viewed as endangering the movement. The complicity of the so-called left in this country, aka the Democrats, with the corporate imperialism has been true all along. And that's sort of how it works. You talked earlier about the Republicans. The Republicans have more of a maverick, breakaway far right wing, who don't agree with the sort of consensus than the Democrats ever have, and the Democrat.
Bob, I have a question for you, and it's a level. It's not a rhetorical question. It's a level question. Relates directly to something to your own argument. You seem to be arguing, and I would agree, that the right wing has had much more success taking over the Republican Party than the left wing has had any success at all taking over the Democratic Party, if I'm hearing your historical account clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it. But I think the left, first, I don't even know what the left is. That's maybe the way we should have started this program. I'm not sure what the left is. But I think, first of all, the left bought into this meritocracy that we talked to. And there were some real good reasons for it, that as long as we had a ruling class by birth, you know, and they all were WASP white men and so forth, it was progressive, to use that word, to be on the side of opening it up, you know, so poor kids could go to better schools or what have you, and so forth. It's turned out to be an enormous trap in that what you're basically doing is selecting better salespeople for the ruling interests, better front people, better company union organizers, and so forth, and without any of the, you know, the original idea of the land-grant colleges, you were supposed to go back to the farm and help improve people's lives and better ways of growing. Well, that doesn't seem to happen. We're hearing nothing at all from Obama as he rises, caring about what's really going on in Chicago or even in Honolulu, you know, where there's considerable unemployment and, you know, suffering as a result. So I agree. I want to pick up and maybe this is a good thing to end on. But we got locked into this whole notion of the big federal government, the big government. And you mentioned early, much way before when we were talking about gay struggles and so forth, that gay people, because they were concentrated in cities, had more impact on local city councils. and so forth. And an idea I'm trying to push for the left, but no one seems to respond to it because we're all sort of hardwired into this notion that the federal government is the center of progressive change, because it was in terms of ending segregation and what have you and setting certain minimal standards of human rights. But I think we have a lot better chance with state and local government. And I think we should return to this notion of states' rights and keeping more of our funds. The question was raised, how do we fund it? Well, if we gave a lower proportion of our taxes to the federal government to support war and other things, you know, right now we have a real point of controversy. Why shouldn't the states be bailed out the way the banks were bailed out? Even Newt Gingrich has supported that in some of his comments. You know, and one of the anomalies of this last election is that some fairly progressive Democrats, not necessarily Jerry Brown, but you know, but others, were elected. The results in California were really quite different than in the rest of the country.
But Jerry Brown now wants to impose an austerity program on the
state. I understand what Jerry Brown wants to do, but I'm just saying, I think we have a better shot of accountability, as you pointed out much earlier on in the segment on the nurses and so forth, union. We have a much better, even of holding a Schwarzenegger accountable on the state level and certainly on the municipal level. And I just think we got frozen into a very old, tired notion of the federal government as the boat for progressive ideas. Yeah,
well, I think, in fact, that if the left is to make a dent in the electoral system, it needs to do it by winning local victories. It's not going to start on the national level. Right. I think what they need to do, they, the Greens, socialists, whatever, is to pick targets and defeat and win on the local level. They need to take over. I mean, go back to Santa Monica. They need to take over local areas at the levels that can be achieved and do, if you like, demonstration projects. You know, you want people to see what can be done by doing it, so that it then becomes an example. And I think the key thing that will happen, if it does, for the left is for people to see that something can work, that you can go outside the two-party oligopoly and make it work. And that will only happen on the local level. It might happen in a state like Vermont, a smallish state in terms of population, or on a municipal level. But that's where it has to happen.
By the way, Vermont is a good example of your argument. Vermont is now going to have a serious public referendum on single-payer health care.
Yeah. I don't know how much longer I can resist pointing out that Bob is carrying on this conversation wearing a shirt that says California Yacht Club.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you
to Robert Scheer, editor of TruthDig.com and author most recently of The Great American Stick-Up, Scott Tucker, author of Rosa Luxemburg and the Libertarian Left.
Thank you.
And thank you, Larry Gross from the Annenberg School. And thank you for your participation in building a powerful left in the United States.
Okay. Onward.